Welcome to Imagine This Podcast, where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all of the excellence and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredibly vibrant arts and culture community in a new way. I'm David Lee.
And I'm Mac Antigua. Well, we are in the throes of winter because I could tell as I was leaving my house today, like my face hurt. Like as soon as I got outside.
Did you run today?
No, I'm not even trying to run when it's like this. You know, I'm just saying like I took my trash out and yeah. I put on my hat. I put my, like sometimes even in the winter, it's like, I'm just running in and out. Yeah. Don't know jacket. Like I put my jacket on, I put gloves on, I cover my head and whatever was exposed hurt. Like that's the winter wind right now.
So, yeah. Usually when those wind chill advisories are out, they're pretty serious.
And I will say overall, at least here in Wisconsin, it feels like the winter has been dialed up in a way that it wasn't like extremes, if that makes sense, right? It's like, yeah, February, this is about right when we get this week of it, the temperature doesn't go over zero kind of thing. Like we didn't get this in November. It wasn't like one of those harsh kind of things. Like,
This is normal. This is totally normal, right?
I mean, I dare I say reasonable, but like even like the snow, like you can kind of see the layers of like, oh, that's the first level of permafrost. And then there's the second level. And it's like, it didn't like fully melt and then come back. And, you know, these sort of messing with the water table. It is sort of this, it's, you know, how you can tell like how old a tree is by its rings. You can tell how the winter is by just looking at my yard.
I just got back from walking the dog and it was literally like ice skating. Like
we went
on like a pretty short round around the neighborhood, given how cold it is. And we were basically just slipping and sliding on all of the thin sheets of ice that are out there.
Mm. So all of our listeners on the coasts and near the Tropic of Capricorn and Cancer cannot relate to anything we're talking about right now. But
although the few listeners from Russia, they totally know what's up.
Absolutely. I think we're really big in the gulag area. Yeah. Prison. Prison work camps. I think that we're a big listen. We're a hot listen. People fighting over.
Can you imagine sending us on like a USO tour to like the
Voice of America? Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's Larry the Cable Guy, Lee Greenwood, and Mac and David from the pod. Yeah, that'll be a heck of a tour, right? That would be a
So long as we're the headliner, I'm okay. I just don't want to be.
Unfortunately, in that lineup, I don't know if we're the headliner. I don't think we're the headliner in that lineup. So I also mentioned. Well, let's acknowledge the elephant in the room. This is the first week in a while we haven't had a guest. And this is a feature, not a bug, right, David?
This is a feature, not a bug. And it also sort of celebrates, actually, I might remind everybody that a year ago was our first episode of the podcast. And so
this isn't an anniversary episode. We're not making
it. Not an anniversary episode, not looking back, but definitely sort of thinking back on that first episode a year ago when we were talking about DNC Arts Activation. It seems so long ago. And yet, you know, here we are in an episode with no guests, sort of thinking a little bit more about talking a little bit more about the work that we're doing and the work of our organizations in the field and the sector at large. So,
yeah, right. So this is sort of this episode is a bit of we're going to kind of dance around. And I think it is actually interesting because I think we're trying to think about some core questions or take on some core questions here and sort of where we're at with it. But so let me start with a story. This is how I like to get into a thing. So I sort of mentioned the cold weather because of the pandemic, even with the pandemic, I'm not going anywhere. You know, it's too cold. My face hurts when I leave the house. So I've just been internet and, you know, watching TV. Right. And so we are in an era now, what is the thing like 50, you know, thousands of channels. It's beyond thousands of channels.
We have it's
so
more many, than thousands. Yeah,
so much abundance. So much abundance of what we can watch, David, right? And I've got time. I got nothing but time, right, on a weekend to do stuff. Like I did my chores or I did whatever I do to keep myself, you know, fit a little bit. So I've got a little bit of window of time. What am I going to do? What do I want to watch? I can watch anything. And so I after doing my favorite show, which is scanning the menu what's popular? What do the algorithm think I want to watch? What's popular in America? And that takes about 45 minutes just to go through that. And then you go through the different platforms. And I was like, I really should watch something. And I just was overwhelmed. So I ended up, I watched Wings. Yes. The sitcom from the late 90s. Yes, Wings, the sitcom that was created by the folks who thought Cheers was too progressive. If you thought Cheers was too madcap, let's set it at an airport in Nantucket. So I watched that sitcom back in the day. I actually got into a Cheers, I got into a Wings Wikipedia rabbit hole because I'm watching, I'm like, let me look up some stuff. And I saw this interview with Tim Daly, who played, if for those of you at home, Wings is pretty much about the hijinks that happens at a small airport in Nantucket, Massachusetts, I believe, if I got my states right. And there's two brothers, the Hackett brothers, who are on Sandpiper Air, small business, right? And again, it's, there you go. It's Cheers, except you have the usual suspects, right? So Tim Daly was in it, who was probably better known for being the sibling of Tyne Daly, who was Cagney and Lacey, right? Oscar, right. You know, Emmy Award winner. So anyway, Tim Daly was also in Diner. He had this thing, Dave, where he reflected on, like, they asked him sort of now, the interview was a cut, you know, sort of an excerpt now. And he sort of like, you know, when I think about that time, we were ran for several years, but we weren't a really hip show. Like, we weren't right. Seinfeld.
Right.
We weren't these things.
Right.
And so at the time, I think I was kind of down about it because I wish more people talked about us. But now when I look back, I go, we were actually a pretty good show. Like, I need kind of need time way to do this. And even Tim Daly now is like, yeah, that wasn't that bad, really. Like the guy who was on the show say this. So I say this all to say is that I watch it because it's familiar and it's dependable. And and there's a little part of me that dies a little bit because I'm kind of like, wow, I have access to everything in the world.
Everything.
And I'm watching Wings. I'm going through 8 seasons of Wings. I'm in season 3 right now. So
I have to say, though, Mac, there's no despair that is quite like the thing that you're describing, right? Which is basically that you have the world of entertainment at your fingertips and you can't find something to watch. And I know you joked about it already a little bit, right? That, you know, the old saw from the cable days that we have 600 channels and nothing to watch. And now we have everything and nothing to watch. I mean, I remember sharing with you over the Christmas break that, like, you know, The Midnight Sky had just been released on Netflix, and it kept the algorithm kept showing it to me to tell me to watch.
You should watch this, David. You should watch Midnight
because
Sky.
It knows that I love space movies and the world movies, and it knows that I love George Clooney, and it knows that I love all the people in that cast.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get myself to do it.
You couldn't pull the trigger. Press the button.
It didn't have to find it. It was in the homepage, right? Like, you just, when you log in, it's like, here, watch this. And I think there's nothing like that despair of, like, seeing something you should be watching or you know you want to watch but not wanting to do it, and then sort of defaulting back to, you know, not defaulting, but, you know, sort of landing on something that maybe is a little bit less a little bit less expensive for a buy-in, right? You don't have to, like, spend 2 hours doing it, and you can watch it.
I do spend 2 hours. I rip off 4 episodes.
But that's the other thing, right? You end up watching 4 episodes. That's right.
What is this the same as when, again, let's rewind to about 20 years ago, maybe, right? 1990s. And I would go to Blockbuster and I would just walk in circles through every row. It's not even like, do they have it in beta? It's not the problem. They have all the movies. It's just, and it always felt like it took me an hour
to find the thing.
I'm perusing.
Yeah, that's right.
So, even, you know, there's been variants of this sort of, you know, this sort of access to a lot abundance, but just kind of defaulting back to, oh, let me go watch Cannonball Run 2. Oh, that was fun. Let me bring that sucker home. No, put back that, you know, that challenging art film from Paris that won Cannes.
Right.
No, let's, right. Let's it's Dom DeLuise and Burt Reynolds again.
it's the ennui brought on by abundance, right? So I think that's right. I rewatched The Exorcist this weekend. Mm. And it's a movie that I've seen, you know, quite a bit. I like the movie. I think it sort of has created the modern blockbuster in many different ways. But it's interesting, right? Again, in the context of all of the stuff that's out there, all of the amazing new stuff that's out there, that, you know, just went back to an old 70s horror movie.
And again, there was a time with cable television when flipping a channel was a thing, right? I would share this again. Some of the listeners don't remember this or didn't do this, but would kind of go through channels. And occasionally there'd be a time where I would land on something where, like, I've seen this movie before.
Yeah.
And I call this a trend of, like, I'm going to stick around. Like, yeah. And for me, those movies are Fletch, Shawshank Redemption. There's a couple more that sort of fit in that, like, I'm gonna finish this out. I've seen it tons of times, but I'm gonna finish it.
It's rewatchable. Yeah,
it's still rewatchable, and it's at the same time, it's like I would rather spend the time here than continually sort of aimlessly shift through all this stuff. Like that happens less and less now, but like it's usually TNT or TBS would know to run that sucker over and over.
Right.
And over.
That's why during the holidays it's always
Major
on,
League.
Right? Yeah.
I'll finish Major League. It's all right. Let's go. Let's do this. Yeah. So
there's a cost of investment, right? So it's sort of like, you know what you're getting. It's comforting versus, you know, do you want to invest in something that's new and sort of get in that sense of emotional investment or time investment and everything else?
Yeah. So, and again, I sort of bring this up not just to talk about my television viewing habits, because I know that's enthralling podcasting, but I think the story that I'm spinning this into, this notion of abundance, like, what do we do in abundance? Yeah. How do we handle abundance? And again, this podcast is devoted to the abundance of stuff in Milwaukee, arts and culture in Milwaukee. And if you're not living in Milwaukee, there's probably an abundance where you're at. And how does one handle that? How does one navigate that without having that sense of being overwhelmed, you know, or defaulting back to the same old steadies? How to navigate that without feeling overwhelmed?
I think that's interesting, right? So there's like the, how do you navigate that without being overwhelmed? And then how do you make sense of all the stuff to be able to, all the stuff that's out there to be able to sort of take action, right? Or sort of move a thing forward. And so I think some of the things so this last week at Imagine, we had our most recent round of work group meetings where we bring together the field to talk about how we want to move together the shared agenda of creating a more thriving and vibrant Milwaukee through arts and culture. And I think a lot of the challenge that we have as staff is that while there is a shared agenda that's been written with, you know, desired results, objectives and tactics and all of that stuff, the world has been shifting and, you know, new contexts bring new opportunities. And so there's this sense of like, do we still continue to move ahead on this, on an agenda that's been written, and we want to sort of continue to move progress on some of these work areas, or do we want to take on new things to sort of address the new context? And I think as staff, we're always trying to figure out how to like marshal people's attention to the most important thing that they can do in the next 3 to 4 weeks, right? Sort of some action they might be able to take. And I think for us, it's always like, how do you put a container around the possibility of all of that, right? Because mm-hmm. I think the right answer is, well, yes, it is both those things. What are you as a member of our work group most interested in doing? And what can you get done to move something forward in, you know, in a short time frame and report back to the group to sort of build momentum, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there is like a sense of, I think we have a sense of curating the abundance of opportunity that's out there, right? To create a vibrant and thriving Milwaukee through the arts in the same way as like some of these services that we're engaging with are making curation devices, right? Or mm-hmm. algorithms that help us make sense of all of the stuff that's out there, right? Like Netflix, HBO Max,
Prime, Spotify, like,
all of them own so much content that we will never know what's at the bottom of it, right? Like, right. So they have to somehow figure out to put in front of us choices for us to be able to engage with. And I think that's really similar to, in some ways, what we're the work that we're trying to do, right? We're trying to curate actions for people to take that will then kind of move the ball forward in one of these four work groups and neighborhood partnerships in marketing, PR, and public policy and support for artists.
You know, David, as you're talking, you're reminding me of a story from my past professional life when I worked in youth development. And there's this notion of how do you look at civic engagement, like young people in civic engagement? And there's sort of a mental model that young people aren't as civically engaged in the past. Now, again, this is a while ago, because obviously as the events of, you know, kids getting gunned in schools and stuff, you know, like young people have definitely gotten more active and stuff. But there was sort of a time where young people were perceived as not as engaged. And more often than not, it was a perception that kids of color, young kids of color, young kids from right. neighborhoods that were disinvested or traditionally left out, you know, not as engaged. And it was interesting to me. I was at a conversation at the Kettering Foundation in Dayton, Ohio, where they really focus on this notion of deliberative democracy. Like, let's bring practitioners together, let's bring academics together in a space to kind of chew on some stuff. Right. So this is very, you know, it's still around doing its thing, but I got to be in the seat development conversation. And one of the interesting that came to mind, David, is that civic engagement, one mental model is, do you vote? Do you go to church?
Right.
Do you do these specific sort of choices, right, that is perceived as civic engagement? However, some folks, practitioners and academics who've worked with, you know, who come from those neighborhoods or worked in those neighborhoods or with kids of color and some and like myself, would observe that just because a young person isn't doing those fill in the blank, you know, those choices, it doesn't mean they're not civically engaged. In fact, some interesting examples of actually young kids, young students who actually go to school where they didn't have like after school extracurricular activities, they found that when those kids were involved in actually talking to the school board about actually getting things like that, like that actually young people or young people were being safe houses for friends who were not feeling safe in their right. own homes or stuff like that. Those are actual civic engagement type muscles, but right. we weren't capturing them and they're being done. So it's there was this notion of like, well, does it exist if we see it and document it? Or if it's the menu we put out, but someone isn't choosing that menu, did it exist? And so that always, like, since then kind of raised my mind of like, again, out there, let's go back to arts and culture. Just because we look at audience numbers, you know, do people go to a show? Or again, pandemic, I know we can't talk about that now, it's different. But this notion of like, well, we know arts and culture is thriving if people are coming to shows or if they're buying tickets or they're buying like, are there other things that we might be missing that suggest that actually people are arts and culture focused or actually arts and culture doing? I don't have an answer to this, but it just sort of led me to wonder, because I think one of the challenges is like, we want to curate as much as possible because right. we want to make it easier. But then by doing so, do we create like this customer mentality where we're missing all the other possibilities that could be, because we're focused on creating efficiencies on a specific transaction? Again, I don't have an answer. It's just something, because I get it. Like, you don't want to have it like, oh, it's only open, anything can happen. But then the fear is you go the other way and then we actually miss something because it's hiding in plain sight.
Well, I think
that resonates with you at all, but that's.
Yeah, no, I think what's interesting about that, Mac, is that, you know, I think the public policy work group meeting on Friday actually had a great example of that, right? Like, we sort of preset that meeting to have a number of different options for people to engage in. And we also opened up the conversation for people to say, you know, well, are these right? Are they wrong? Are there other projects or things that people want to work on to sort of create the sense of broadest engagement? And what I thought was really interesting about that meeting, Mac, and I don't know how what your take on it was, but the conversation that really opened up was not about any one of those things, right? Like, I think people broadly agreed that, hey, if we create a blueprint for arts and culture, that's probably pretty good. If we organize some campaigns to raise or protect public funding for the arts, that's probably good. But what they were getting after was like, how do we actually create a broad-based movement, right, mm-hmm. to support the advocacy goals of the sector, mm-hmm. right? And I think that is really powerful, right? That's a different kind of conversation than the thing we were talking about. I think the yeah. things that we're talking about yeah. were sort of like tactics that would help to support that, but they're really right. talking about how do we organize a real sort of like day-to-day campaign where people are sort of systematically building power within the system, the ecosystem. And I think that yeah. is... that's something else than what we plan for, right? We plan for, give us your action commitments to help us do this public policy blueprint, but people seem to be more interested in the how do we build the tools to sort of deploy a broader kind of campaign about the importance of arts and culture? And that's something we just didn't expect, right? And if you get people who are engaged and who are interested and who have that kind of a fire, right? I think that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah, it's great, you know, because I think on one level, right, as someone who designs meetings and designs agendas and supports the execution meetings, there's a little bit of a, oh no, this is not what we planned on talking about. But I think the excitement for me was, this is a much more compelling conversation than the one I might have planned for. And more importantly, that's what the conversation of the majority of the people in the room that we could tell wanted to have, right? And so the challenge is, how do you meet people where they're at? And hold that conversation for them. And I think the challenge, David, for me anyway, is to be okay with, like, I don't have all the answers. Like, I don't know the answer to that question. That's a great question, right? And to be vulnerable and being, okay, well, what can I do to hold a space so that folks can weigh in on it or add, you know, figure out, or again, give the work back to folks going, well, what do you think what it is? Because there, you know, sometimes I feel like, well, how come you don't know the answer to this? Like, that's always sort of a running conversation in my head that I always have to fight, you know, because and the reason why that matters, it's not saying like don't be a professional or don't care. I think the thing about it is, a lot of the problems that we're trying to solve for don't have the obvious answers.
If they had answers, people would have already done them.
So sometimes, again, it goes back to, again, a really fascinating insight that one of my I came across, someone had shared with me once, when, you know, talking about funding, right? I forget who I was talking to, but you know, we were talking about doing, you know, foundations, you talk to program officers about the work, right? And sometimes there's this sort of, in my mind, from my experience, there's almost this performative element. Like, as the grantee, I got to prove that I got the best program that you're going to fund. And I have to show the logic model that's perfect. And, you know, that's a mindset that I had. And I remember one of my friends said, you know, colleagues at charity's like, yeah, you could do that. Or one other take could be, how hard is the problem that you're really trying to solve? And are you able to ask really interesting questions in service of that? Because I think that's what folks want to invest in, right? An even more difficult problem. And not saying you have the answer today, but do you have a compelling design of how you might get to an answer? That kind of, like, you know, again, that galaxy brain, it's like, oh, I thought I had to have the answer. And again, maybe it's privilege. Maybe this person's like really good at what they do and they always won at funding. So maybe that's where they're at. But they're like, no, I tended to have better meetings when I actually had more ambitious questions. And hopefully we were the kind of grantee that could answer that question or had authority to. But I think that's what that just resonated for me. This notion of, how do you create a space with really hard questions that people want to take on and take action on? So,
you know, in our prep for this show, you had sort of brought up this framing of civic versus consumer. Mm-hmm. And you talked about it a little bit just now. And just to pick up a little bit about that, I think there's something about that frame that I think even in the nonprofit world, right, like we've succumbed to a little bit, right? Like it sort of becomes a little bit of that sort of like venture funding cycle, right? Like, can you build a better widget? Mm-hmm. To get your next round of funding, can you build a better program that's going to serve more kids or whatever it is? But we're really at that point really only counting the people who are coming through the program and not, mm-hmm, sort of dealing with the reason why you have to have the program there in the first place, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Which is more of a systems question.
Yeah.
And I think there is like this, I think, problem with framing fundamental problems of society or problems of capitalism, right, in the context of capitalism, right? Because then you're only getting back the same kinds of engagements that lead you to the same answers. I think the best example of this is, from my perspective, is like when you think, when people talk about, we need to run business more like a government, or I'm sorry, we need to run, probably, that was a little bit of a slip there. We need to run government more like a business.
Yeah.
It's, I think the problem with that is you boil down all of the different ways that people engage with government in a sort of consumer transaction, right? Like whether it's, I need a driver's license, so I'm a consumer, I'm going to go to the DMV to get my license and pay them for some stuff. As opposed to, I think, this broader point you're trying to make about being a civic citizen, being we, from our Road to Democracy series, we learned that there's some anxiety, not anxiety, but just some feeling about the word citizen, but being a member of a civic community, means that you do more than, you know, go get your license from the DMV. You do more than just, you know, pay your taxes. You are a good neighbor. You do these things that make you be a part of the civic community in ways that are not, that don't make you a consumer, right? Mm-hmm. That sort of make you a neighbor.
You're part owner.
Right.
You're acting that's like right. You're part owner, right? Like,
that's right.
You go a little bit extra, right? And again, it's, I think that's one of the, and I think, you know, as I sort of reflect on this conversation, David, like, I think there's a real desire back to this notion of efficiency, like make it easy, make the deal easier for me. I don't know what to watch. Make it easy for me, right? Like what should I watch? And I think part of living in the now with problems that affect us that we don't have solutions for, you have to be able to sit with complexity. You have to be able to sit in uncomfortable, I don't know space, but yet do that in a way that you're not, one isn't paralyzed.
Yeah.
Or frustrated too much that you're not like just tuning out and then self-medicating with bad television or whatever, you know, alcohol or something. Right. And I think there is something, this notion of how do you hold a space, be with someone in a space or be with others in a space where you're holding conflicting ideas and getting to something, you know, and again, I think we're pulling on a thread that crosses over to a lot of areas of our shared society, right? Which we're not really well built for right now.
I think
is holding. Right. Holding that. And I go back to, I think that's the promise of art and culture, is that actually art and culture provide that. Not that I'm buying art to soothe me. Yeah, I get, yes, maybe going to an artistic experience or a cultural experience has ameliorative effects that are soothing or welcoming. But also I think art and culture invite us to take journeys and trips to point of views that aren't ours. And that if we actually take the trip, then we get to find something new about ourselves, or maybe get challenged, as I think like Jason Oz had talked about several episodes,
right.
what that afforded him, those cultural journeys. And again, that's by really engaging, not to say there's a right way in engaging in art, but I would offer that if there's a way to engage in art that way, it builds your own muscle, if you will, or perhaps builds your latitude to sit with the difficult, don't know what's right. You know, and I think that's like, again, going back, like we need more of that, more exposure to that, because I think a lot of times we're able to go to our own corners and go to our own echo chambers and all these things. And I think that's, you know, again, for me, when I'm reflecting in this moment, you know, in this conversation of this particular episode, is like, I think that's what I'm trying to navigate overall, you know, in a professional role, but also I think in a society role, when I think of myself as a citizen. You know, because I think if we're left, we're on defaults, David, right? That if we get too efficient, what natural law teaches us is that systems that are hyper-efficient ultimately die.
Or they fail, right? Because there's no redundancy. That's right.
Right, right.
I think the best example of this, right, is the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, right? Like, like, it failed because the safety systems were so efficient that like once one thing failed, it was done. There were no other safety mechanisms, right?
Or even like the stock market crashes of the 80s or like the first index arbitrage, right? All the computers were super effective.
Yeah.
The algorithm was super effective to dump stocks at certain points. So it was just this cascade
of
dumping, right? To the point that it couldn't stop itself, right? And so I'm not saying we should be inefficient, or back to this notion of like, when people say, hey, government should work like a business, I think it's fascinating that the assumption is that people in government are lazy or don't want to be efficient, because I've met some folks that work in government. They want things to work out as best as possible, right? It's the mental model, you know, isn't that we don't want government, we don't want things to be efficient or work at the best. I think when you say, you offer government should be a business. I know business operate with amorality, right? And I think what governments have to function more, when I say moral, they have to help everybody that's in this thing, right? Not because, well, there's not enough of you. So we can't, it's not worth it. It's not worth it for us to build this product for you.
Yeah.
Is there only one of you? Sorry, you're in a wheelchair. There's only 20 people in our township that live in a wheelchair. So we can't deal with you. Sorry, we're going to deal with the, you know, our market is the 9,880 able-bodied people that are able to not use a wheelchair. So we're going to keep the curbs high. No, government's was like, well, what's the path for these 20 to function? And I think that's you know, that's, and that shouldn't, David, that's not just government's job. That's all of, all of our paths to figure out how, well, how can this person feel included no matter what, you know, their situation is.
I'm going to pull a fun story from my previous days fighting hunger. I actually said this to a congressperson in a lobby meeting one time, and I think it made that person's head explode. You know, and this idea that like government ought to function more like a business, right? You know, the food stamps program, highly efficient program that provides people who are of low income with money to go buy food. It operates, the last I checked, with about like 99% efficiency. So basically 1% fraud or 1.5% fraud. Any business that could report a loss rate of 1%, you would study them, right? You would study this business at like Harvard Business School, because that's unbelievable. But people just don't, when you share that story, right, it just doesn't fit in people's mental model or their mental frame of what government is. And actually that's one thing the government does really, really well. It does mass payments to individual citizens incredibly well. I don't know if our listeners out there have already gotten your second round of stimulus checks. You probably did. It's because government does that stuff really, really well, right? Like they know how to do that. So we should let the government do the things it does really well. Like, right. Redistribute money to let them do it, right?
Again, and this is not a panacea to say that folks can't be better at their jobs or systems can't be sharper. But at the same time, there's a sort of balance between, but how about we trust the people that I think want to do that job, right? And let them figure out how to do it. So all this to say, right, is that it's a very... it's an interesting time to figure out how to support, you know, again, back to our work here at Imagine and sort of the, you know, what we want to do is have arts and culture be available and accessible, like it's air and water. And it's essential, like it's air and water. Right. And actually what I think we want more people to see is that you're actually not just a consumer of art, but you're actually a creator of art and culture more than you know. Because I think one of the things I hold is that however you do what you do is art, right? Like that is art, because you are bringing something human, you're bringing something yourself, a signature to whatever it is you do. And sometimes it's fine art and it's on canvas, or it's performance art, or sometimes it's the way you arrange, you know, your day, or the way you arrange your files. I don't know, but there's gotta be, if you're really bringing yourself to it, I believe, that the execution of that is some sort of art, because it's human, it's you. The second part of that is, I think culture is the amalgamation and the artifacts of all these things that we do. You know, it's not just the creation of these things, but it's the patterns and the interactions we have collectively that have, you know, there's a way that Milwaukeeans engage. Part of that's influenced by the fact that we can't really go east because there's a big lake in the way, right? Like that affects, you know, how we move and how we engage, or the fact that we make conscious choices about where our green spaces are and how we preserve them, or that we congregate ideally in the middle of summer and open all these stages and have them come and perform in open air, right? Like by those conscious choices, we create a culture together. And I think the challenge is the fact that these are not just for the professionals that create arts and culture, but everyone, even if we're just paying a ticket, is creating a culture together. And so if that is true, then we all have a role in having a voice of what that is and not deferring to, you know, fewer folks or creating this notion of it's just a transaction. You go up there, you entertain me, and that's art. You know, I think it's more than that. And I think that's,
I think that's right. And I think that's really at the core of the idea of a creative and vibrant city, right? Is that we have not only, I think the rich and vibrant and incredible arts and culture scene is a part of that. I think what you're getting after, Mac, too, is that this sense of like, how are people showing up to that, right? How are people living in community with each other, with their friends and neighbors, and like how we are all coming together as a society in a way that is creative, connected, and inclusive. And I think that's a vision that any city, ought to be working towards.
So as we kind of pivot towards year two of this podcast, and I'm assuming we're going to keep doing it. We'll see. maybe this is the last episode. I don't know. We're all day to day, right? But I think the focus for me when I think about why doing this podcast is, where's the space to keep exploring that conversation of, you know, how do we make sure things are abundant and that folks are not only take part in it, but also know it's not taken for granted, and that we all have a role in ensuring its abundance, not just for us, but also for the generations that are coming after us, right? And creating that. I'd like to think our podcast is going to keep bringing on folks who are taking that on in real time, as well as folks who are trying different ways of not just practicing art or performing art, but also creating the conditions or doing things in a way that they're creating conditions for more folks to have it. And as a result, our city's going to be brighter. Our city's going to be more welcoming. And in fact, our city's going to be more exciting. You know, it's going to, more people are going to want to be here because they can palpably feel folks' humanity being invited to be shared through this.
We didn't expect this to be a year in review episode, but somehow in our discussion, it became a year in review, a podcast in review episode, revisiting the mission statement of this podcast.
Well, I'm sure we invited a lot of our listeners to rethink, why do I bother listening to this podcast? We hope it's a better answer than there was the year before. And we hope that you enjoyed
this. Well, at least we're asking actually a question this time. At least we have a point of view this time, as opposed to like, hey, we should do a podcast to review our work groups and to talk a little bit about our work. And given that we don't have a newsletter, maybe this can be our audio newsletter. I think that's basically how it started.
Yeah. It's continued to go. And then again, our audience has gotten slowly bigger and bigger. So we thank all of y'all for continuing to listen and check us out every Tuesday. And also sending us your notes or some of our friends texting me their notes. thanks for your critical notes on the pod. We're going to try. They're more towards me. I would share them with you if it had anything to do with you. It's more my own performance. So I'm trying my best to take their notes and do that. So Dan Condon. But that being said, we're really grateful for our listeners. And if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to keep supporting the pod, please keep sharing it out or share it on social. Leave a rating or contact us directly at pod@imaginemke.org.
Imagine This Podcast is edited by David Lee and is hosted by and produced by Mac Antigua and David Lee, and is the flagship of the Imagine MKE Podcast Network. Go listen to our sibling podcasts, Arts Forward MKE and Black Imagination, all of which can be found at imaginemke.org/podcasts.
While you're on the socials, you can catch all the latest from Imagine MKE by going to our Twitter and Instagram at @imagine_MKE. Or if you're on the Big Blue Facebook, go to just Imagine MKE.
Thanks again, and we'll catch you here next Tuesday. Hey, Mac, before we go, who you like in the Super Bowl?
I'd like a big earthquake to swallow up both teams and make the other 28 teams happy. But in light of environmental catastrophe, my predictions, I think The Weeknd will have an excellent halftime show because The Weeknd's going to bring back the halftime show with a terrific performance. And I think the Chiefs are going to put up 80 points because you can't stop them. No one can stop them. It's Tecmo Bowl. It's crazy. You can't stop them.
Chiefs repeat, definitely Mahomes Tecmo Bowl. Mahomes Brady is sort of Super Bowl legend.
And then the next story after that is that the Bears will trade everything to get Carson Wentz.
Thought they did that already.
Oh, gosh. What an awful day. Well, I'll go walk straight outside without a coat on and just keep walking into Lake Michigan then. That's my next steps.
We'll see you next week.
Bye. Favorite commercial you're looking forward to tonight?
It's gonna be an interesting year for commercials, right? I haven't read any of the pre thought pieces on it.
Hype. The pre hype. I think aren't some companies sitting it out?
You share that with me last week, or I don't know if.
No, I was talking to somebody at Orange Theory this week.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd heard of that. But I don't know much about who's sitting out and what we're going to be missing. I think in some ways, right, like the Super Bowl commercials are less about like, it's about splashiness, but it's less about like, I think it feels like it's less about awareness, particularly at that level. It's more about like engagement in the cultural activity, right? Like you expect, yeah, you expect Budweiser to have a commercial. You expect Coke to have a commercial about togetherness and happiness or whatever. It's like at that level,
Pepsi's about youth. Yeah, Pepsi's gonna be something about youth.
It feels less about like, hey, Pepsi, like, you know, we're gonna get some more Coke drinkers, right? It's about like sort of putting out your sort of brand cult, your brand statement, right? Your what you're about this year. Or it feels like it's like less about marketing and more about like being a part of the cultural conversation.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we didn't talk about this on the pod, but I think the notion of like, we're gonna watch the Super Bowl mainly for like, I'm watching for like, what's the message? Like, what are the messages that are relevant right now that these commercials are speaking to? Last year at this time, it was like, what, Black Lives Matter? No. Wasn't it more earnest last year at this time?
I think so.
It wasn't pandemic because we weren't there yet. But it was more earnest, right?
I think it was more earnest. More like, I can't remember. I actually think in the last few years it's been more earnest. It's been both more earnest and also more political.
Yes.
These last few years. So it'll be interesting to see now that this last administration has transitioned out. And also a year into this pandemic, what these commercials are going to be like. And I think that's sort of what I was saying earlier about the kind of like cultural conversation, right, that happens surrounding the commercials, right? Like there's something about like it's reflecting back to, you know, the largest audience in America, sort of what commerce is thinking about, right? And in some ways what we're thinking about.
Right. And there's no shortage of like, serious sounding music with like a narrative going, I know times are tough. Da, 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 da. Right. I feel like last year we saw a lot of those commercials. Right. Again, maybe not at the Super Bowl, but definitely like that notion of like, and there's probably gonna be a lot of stories about probably a lot of commercials about healthcare, like workers.
Right.
Or commercials about coming back.
Aren't there like, isn't all of the folks in the stands healthcare workers?
7,500, I think 7,500 participants are like healthcare workers, frontline responders, first responders and stuff like that. Because that's the NFL's most, we should have talked about this. Why is the NFL having a poet?
Why are they?
What do you think?
They have one?
Amanda Gorman.
Wait, she's doing a poem at the.
How are we not talking about this? Yeah, she's been hyped as she's going to be performing probably right after the, you know, around the time of the national anthem. She's going to do a poem.
Oh wow, wow! I didn't hear about that. I totally missed that.
We should have led with that.
Well, this is the special bonus pod because we're still recording, so I can append this to the end of the episode.
Amanda Gorman. This was like several weeks ago, like right after the Super Bowl poem. She's going to do a recite poetry before Super Bowl. Her new poem will honor three Americans, Los Angeles educator Tremaine Davis, Florida nurse manager Susie Dorner, and Pittsburgh-based James Martin, a Marine veteran who volunteers for the Wounded Warrior Project.
Wow.
So
it's in the pre-show festivities before
the national anthem. Around the time, right, probably right before the national anthem. Yeah. But here's the thing, right? Like, and apparently Roc Nation, which is Jay-Z's production company, entertainment company, is partnered with the NFL around social justice awareness.
Still won't sign Kaepernick, though.
I think it was in light of that they did that. But yeah, see, it's no anyway. But here's the thing, right? Like, isn't that incredibly responsive to the NFL to be like, hey man, Amanda Gorman was probably the one person that was most talked about after the inauguration. We got to book her. let's book her for the Super Bowl. And they pulled it off in a relatively short amount of time. Like, that just feels to me very like fast and very agile for the NFL, which is not what I associate with fast and agile. Definitely on the field. Sorry, with apologies to JJ Watt. Yes, fast, you are fast and agile. But in terms of like their sense of the moment and being like, I'm sure there are a lot of people that are like, all right, I'm going to check out Amanda Gorman. It almost feels like when like Lorne Michaels stunt casted for SNL hosts. Like, we're going to get Sarah Palin. Like, what? Okay,
right.
Okay, I guess I'll watch this. And this is where we do the bit of what poem, if it's not the hill we climb, is it the left tackle I will force over? Is it? If we only see the screen, we can be the screen. If we can only
so
hit that out.
Again, going back to our earlier conversation about curation, right? And how do you cut through the clutter? I am a sports fan. I am also an arts and culture fan. I'm also, as you know, I've been talking in our staff meeting about how Amanda Gorman, I'm also an Amanda Gorman fan.
Sure, why wouldn't you?
How did this news miss me? until like 3 hours before kickoff.
A scant two hours. Yeah, how did it miss you? The algorithm should have found you. It should have heard you talking about this on our Zoom call.
That's right.
And then
meanwhile,
wend its way through your browser.
Meanwhile, it's serving me up, you know, ads about kettle chips that you had mentioned a couple weeks ago. I've never searched for kettle chips, and somehow I know more about kettle chips at Walmart or at Whole Foods than I do about this.
But David, isn't this a time to be alive that a 22-year-old poet is arguably our most popular public statesperson?
It's incredible.
Right now. And she's worthy of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely worthy of it, right? Which is phenomenal. But it's like, yeah, we're going to put you in front of the Super Bowl. David, Republican inaugurations have never had a poet.
That's right.
The Super Bowl is going to have its first poet.
Modern American Republicans have not had a poet. But yes, you're right. Oh, that's right.
Are you taking over Chester Arthur's inauguration when...
No, but I think it's incredible. And I think, you know, going back to your point about like about the NFL being responsive, do you think this is sort of an unassailable choice they could have made and they would have made it anyways? Or do you think this is actually a signal of a sense of maybe some change, right? Some ability to be more responsive, be more inclusive of other voices that may kind of confront the hegemony of the NFL.
So I think there's no argument that the NFL is the most powerful sports league in this country that loves its sports leagues. If we look at every live telecast from the last year in ratings wise, I think of the top 20, 18 of them are football games.
Right.
So it's evident that, you know, CBS, NBC, ABC/ESPN, Fox, they all have contracts to air their programming and they do not want to anger NFL because they need their programming. Right. So to your point, when you say hegemony, right, like the NFL has the collective attention. And again, as evidenced by the Super Bowl, will have the collective attention of a country to watch this game. For them to go, we're going to put a poet in front.
It's incredible.
It's amazing. But here's the other thing that I wonder since then, like I know like at a, they've really tried to, and again, this is not me just spouting the PR stuff. I've sort of observed they've run social justice grants that have been initiated by players, right, with support of their teams. And again, I can't vouch for the veracity of like if these are the right grantees in local things, but they've invested. And again, I know it's not everything, but they've invested time. They've tried to do some more storytelling with other. I think they partnered with one of the Centers for Sport, you know, and to think about sort of the NFL's place in these things. So I just sort of wonder maybe this is actually an outgrowth of that agility, right? That they've been building over a couple, partnering with folks like Jay-Z and Roc Nation. But I would say that if your labor, right? If your stars are predominantly African-American or predominantly from the communities that might not be as engaged, you know, in the leadership of your product, and you figure out ways to include their voice, and you go, oh, maybe this is an evidence of like, yeah, we're going to have poetry ahead of it, you know?
Yeah.
It is fascinating. And again, it's like, I get my wonderings is if I'm someone who didn't want Vice President Biden to become president, and I actively see someone that was from that experience performing, I might have feelings about that. Like, why is the NFL doing this?
Right.
The NFL's like, nah, we're going to live with that.
Right.
I mean, I guess if you want to assail a 22-year-old dynamic young woman who has a way with words, I guess if you're against it, we're going to live with that. Like, we'll live with the haters. It's like, wow, okay.
NFL. In some ways, I hate saying this, right? Because it feels like I'm giving, you know, the our nation's, you know, most powerful sports league a pass, right? But it does feel a little like, you know, 5 years ago, they would never make this choice, right? Like, it would be, no. You know, like, any sense of ruffling the feathers of its main constituency, for whatever reason, it would have been radioactive to them, right? And so for them to even in this context be like, you know what, just to your point, right, to the inaugural poet is going to have 5-10 minutes before the national anthem to honor people, right, on at center field with some poetry. That's incredible.
What a moment.
Yeah, what a moment.
Right. And so this is a win for arts and culture in our country to have a poet in the most, wow. And again, an amazing poet. And hopefully it becomes one of those, another path for people to think about what is the role of poetry in our lives. You know, some would argue, you know, in a lot of ways, football is visual poetry and just the seeing these amazing athletes run at full speed and do everything, you know, in the armor of the pads and the helmets and whatnot. And yet, do some amazing things, or Tom Brady at age 90 doing what he's doing, right? I think poetry's a natural, you know. And again, NFL, but hey, here's another thing, David. NFL films.
Oh yeah,
in the 1960s, absolutely. You know, that was this notion absolutely. Of using a medium of film to tell the message. So maybe
they
NFL isn't that far.
They had to pioneer how to zoom in from 100 yards away on a flying football. You know that incredible shot that is sort of become the NFL film signature. That is really hard to do, right? Like technically that is incredibly difficult to do.
Right. Made it accessible in the middle of the game. Made it obvious, right? Made it obvious and accessible to all of us, right? But you know, the fact that I guess it's to say, like, maybe they've been hiding in plain sight. I think the NFL does understand on some level the role of arts and cultural elements.
Well, I think we've been talking about it, right? Like, even the context of, like, in the context of the commercials, right, is sort of part of this cultural conversation that the nation is trying to have, right, with itself or with commerce.
And being the country it is, you know, it would make sense. It's commercials.
Yeah, that's right.
It would make sense. Yeah, it did make sense.
I mean, the halftime show is often derided, but also when it hits, it is, you know, it is sort of an incredible cultural moment. Not to say, nothing about the fact that it is, you know, our nation's, top music and, you know, dance acts, right? Sort of coming together to like do their work. I think there is this. I think we've even talked about it at the office, right? Like the what is the intersection between our sector, right? Arts and culture, with sports and entertainment, right? There is the overlapping Venn diagram segments are actually, it's a big overlap, right? There's a pretty big overlap of how our two sectors are more similar than they are dissimilar.
I think also in the time now, which is hyper segmented with music, to pick someone like The Weeknd, who's probably the closest thing to a mainstream act now, I would say only closest thing in terms of the Weeknd's Billboard success.
Oh yeah, he's this generation's Michael Jackson, right? Like
sure, but I guarantee that he's not as widely known as Michael Jackson and Michael Jackson's time.
Sure, that makes sense.
That's right. Right, but so I would say so. What's fascinating is that my point, one of the things I'm thinking about is sometimes halftime shows is like the Hall of Fame performance.
Yeah.
Like you get it because you're the safest act possible, right? We're not going to offend. Like, oh yeah, I get it. You too. Makes sense. Oh, okay. Aerosmith. Fine. That makes sense.
Right.
Like there's these acts that are picked that you're like, yeah, sure. I could see the resume. Fine. And then there are some acts that are picked because they're actually of the time.
Of the moment. Yeah.
You know, like really of the moment. Not like the when Pepsi did the MTV halftime, the actually notorious one where Justin Timberlake Jackson and right, but that was like none of those acts were like, oh yeah, this is an act that we anticipate it's going to be around forever, you know, although you could argue Janet Jackson had some success previous. I think what's interesting, like to me, The Weeknd's almost bridging these things because in theory, like we should all know The Weeknd, but because we're so hyper
separated. Like, I don't think everybody, there's going to be enough people going like, why is that bandage on? What's the deal?
Why does he look like he's in a car crash?
Why is he out there like this? Why is he even performing, right? There's going to be enough people who aren't in on the bit. And in some way, this is going to be seem like the most progressive Super Bowl ever, because you're going to have a poet and then you have the Weeknd before you have time performing his retro, you know, futuristic, nostalgic tunes.
Produced by your boy, Max Martin.
My guy, Max Martin. Yes, my guy, Max Martin. Ultimately, Sweden wins the pop game. So who knew that this might be the most, you know, and again, we're going to get commercials talking about the NFL's role in supporting Black Lives Matter, because they're going to cash in on that investment too. So I think it'll be an interesting framing of the league, right?
Yeah.
In this way of trying to present itself as with its players at the very least. I mean, because I'm sure they heard from their players. Like, you know, it's like.
All in the context of the NFL doing this crazy experiment of playing all of their games in home stadiums, trying to manage this crazy schedule where, I mean, my 49ers played a couple of home games in Arizona where the rates of COVID were higher than they were in California, but because you couldn't, you know, because of the public health problems, right? Like,
could have easily been the Fire Festival of sports.
Oh yeah, it could. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Very much. I say that being like, if you're in the room in August, hey, we're going to do this. People like me and you're like, this is not going to work. Like, no, man. Like, no, how are we going to do this?
So many people injured, so many people on the COVID list.
Seriously, really, we're gonna do this thing? That would have been me in the meeting. No, it's not gonna happen.
In the context of all of that, coming into 12 months into this pandemic, out of 4 years of a very uncertain presidential administration, I think this is like the Super Bowl, for better or for worse, right? It is sort of is one of those moments where we all check in with each other to see how we're doing, right? And I think this is gonna be really interesting tonight.
I also think, and you know, I like that framing, David, and you know that's going to be done. It's not going to be like, we're doing okay, right? It's going to be a lean. You're doing right, right? You're doing right. It's not going to be like, how are you doing? I want to authentically hear your answer. It's going to be like, you doing all right? You doing all right? Nodding, getting you to go, yeah. And that whole country's going to go, yeah, yeah, I'm doing all right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't want to get into it now, but yeah, sure. Just play the game. Yeah, it's fine.
Can I get some 3D Doritos? Super cool ranch flavor?
Yeah. Yeah. Show me the commercials. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine enough. I got to go to work tomorrow. Come on. Let's make this work.